It's a pleasure to have Mario Spina in studio with us this morning. Mario's going to talk about his family's experience. These were charges that were brought forward actually on his son. Three charges, one that was withdrawn before it even went to trial, and the other two he was acquitted on. Mario, first of all, welcome to Heart FM. Thanks for coming in and sharing your story, but you also had a bit of a preamble that you wanted to give.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I really appreciate being here. I just want to share our experience with the citizens of Woodstock, what my son and my family have been through for the last year plus. We want to provide some knowledge on what we've learned as far as how to protect yourselves on your phones and your apps. And we also want to share our experience that we had with the police ordeal and in the courts. And I've learned a lot, but I'm not giving any legal advice or any forensics advice. What I'm about to say is what I've learned from the trial transcripts. And I've read those many times, learned from dealing with lawyers and forensic people, criminal lawyers, civil lawyers, everybody. And just want to share what I've learned. But again, I'm not giving any legal or forensics advice. And what I'm about to say is from in my own personal opinion.
Your family's experience centers around your son, and it takes you back to like the beginning of 2022.
Yes, it was January 19th in 2022. And we had a doorbell was rung at our house at 8:15 in the morning, and my wife answered the door, and six police officers were there with a search warrant to search our home. She let them in. We fully cooperated. I woke up. I was just getting up, starting my day. My son wasn't home, and they read us our rights. They told us we could contact a lawyer, and basically they were there alleging that something went through our home router, child pornography, stemming from a Snapchat account. So they put us all in the living room, and they searched the home. We gave them all our devices, laptops, computers, tablets, cell phones, camera card from my photo camera, and we waited.
Wow. That must have been pretty nerve-wracking. How long were you, do you call it being sequestered to your
living room? Yeah, sequestered. We were in the living room and for about a good 90 minutes.
Okay.
Again, we cooperated. Everything was calm. We offered them coffee. And then we waited. But when the doorbell rang, my wife was really scared because she thought something happened to my son.
All right.
Because he wasn't home. But they told us why they were there. So there was a part during that search warrant where the detective and another officer went to my son's place of employment to speak with him and to get the current cell phone that he in his possession. And then by around noon of that day, I started getting some of our stuff back, like my phone, my laptop, and some of my daughter's laptop and phone. But all his stuff they kept.
So what's the next stage in this process now? This is in January of 2022. When did you hear from police next?
It was about 2 weeks later. I reached out to the detective to find out, where they're at.
Yeah.
Because we were really confident there was nothing there because my son isn't this type of person. So on February 3rd, he spoke directly with my son. And my son at the time was 19 years old. And this is about an alleged upload through a Snapchat account that happened in August prior, so August of 2021.
Oh, okay.
So they found thumbnail images deep within the Snapchat application on one of his old phones. So they had four of my son's phones. We don't get rid of the phones. We keep the keepsakes, or maybe if we go to Cuba, we give them to to people down there.
Yeah.
So at that time, because it was 2 weeks that basically transpired, when I got my stuff back, I started doing some digging on my own. And the authenticating email that was used for the Snapchat account, and this was an account that my son set up when he was in grade 8, grade 9, so he was a young kid, and he only needed one email to set up the account. I started digging into the Rogers email address because it was a Rogers email that was used for the Snapchat to see if maybe Snapchat was trying to tell us something. And they were. We stopped using that Rogers email address for about 4 or 5 years maybe because it was full of junk mail and spam. And we didn't have it linked to any of our other devices. Otherwise, it'd be constantly pinging. We switched everything over to Gmail and just stopped using it. We would have loved to have deleted it, but you can't delete a primary Rogers email address unless you delete the entire account. Well, we didn't want to do that because everything was set up with Rogers. You can delete secondary emails, but not the primary one.
Okay.
So we just kind of basically ignored it. I found stuff of suspicious activity happening in Snapchat prior to the alleged upload. I also found a lot of stuff on Instagram because two platforms were hacked. And when we say hacked, or I say hacked, I mean that in a broad sense of the word. It can be a whole bunch of things, but basically what happened here was identity theft. But that's what I understand. The word that I use is hack. So my son told the detective over the phone that he has an email from Snapchat that somebody got into his account prior to the alleged upload. And the detective said, we don't want to charge anybody who's not criminally involved here. But when you're in this situation, nobody comes to help you.
Right.
You're on your own. So we used a local lawyer to get him on bail. And any lawyer is basically going to tell you, exercise your charter right to remain silent, because the police can, and many times will, use whatever you say against you. So the next morning, I brought my son to be arrested at the police station.
And sorry, this is 2 weeks after, Mario?
2 weeks after, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So on February 3rd was the first contact we had since the search warrant. That's when my son spoke with the detective. And he said he found thumbnails. And my son said, I got some proof here that somebody got into my account. And the next morning, I brought my son to the police station to be arrested. The detective never asked for the email, but my son never volunteered it either,
okay,
on the advice of his counsel. And then he was taken in, fingerprinted, and photoed, and put in a jail cell and the holding cell for the day, basically. And everything was done online at that time. They made him take his shoelaces out in case he wanted to hang himself. So he was, he's traumatized as an innocent person, young man with no criminal history to speak of. And he's in the basement of the Woodstock police station.
So at that time when he was charged, were the three charges placed right then?
Yes, they were placed then. Then he was released on bail. So we picked him up from the police station at 3:30. And I remember it was a lot of snow that day. It was cold. And by 4:30, the police issued a media release with the charges and his name. And then it just spread like wildfire.
So this is in February 2022. What's the next step? Are you just waiting to see what information the police come back with, or what happens next?
So basically, at that point, we start looking for a lawyer who we want to take this case on. The bail lawyer did a good job, but we needed somebody with more experience in this field and more top shelf, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that was scary. That scared me more than the police, to be honest with you, trying to find a lawyer to represent my son who has experience with, child pornography type cases. They make your knees buckle because they didn't get too much hope from some of these guys, especially when it comes to the hacking theory. Mm-hmm. But we found a lawyer in Toronto, Michelle Bedell from Greenspan, Humphrey and Weinstein, and she was brilliant, and she instilled a calm in us, and she held our hand and got us through all this and said that it can be explained, and I know your boy didn't do this. So at that point, we also solicited a forensics expert, which I don't know any of this stuff. Like, I've never spoke with a criminal lawyer in my life. I've never dealt with anything with forensics, of course. And the way we got onto him was we have a friend of our family, soon to be daughter's brother-in-law. Anyways,
yeah.
He is the digital forensics examiner for the Canadian military.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for the Department of National Defense. And he does this at the highest level of the country for national security. So we were basically at the top of the food chain with him. And when he caught wind of what happened, he says, give me a couple of days and I'll see if I can find somebody for you. But in Canada, we don't take digital forensics as seriously as it's taken in the U.S., according to this person. And you have to find somebody who has experience in court as well, too. Because you have to present all this technical stuff to a judge who may or may not have much computer literacy.
Yeah.
So it's complicated and delicate, so to speak. 2 days later, he found Jason Conley.
Okay.
And Jason was working for a company called Invista Forensics. They're based out of the U.S. And he was on board immediately. And he says, this is full of holes. So he started doing his things. And all this is happening while we're waiting for full and complete disclosure from the Crown. So that takes about 4 months. And once we got that full and complete disclosure, now we knew all the evidence that they had. And basically the evidence that the Crown had was the cyber tip that came in.
Okay.
So when something goes through a Snapchat server or a Facebook server, for example, And if it's already been identified as child exploitation, so a lot of these files or images or videos that, which are constantly floating in the clouds, they've already been identified and by stored in a national database, and they've been assigned a digital fingerprint. And rightfully so, we support this 100%. Mm-hmm. When something goes through an account, the servers notify the authorities, and off it goes. So it makes its way from the National Center on Missing and Exploited Children in the States, because it's Snapchat's U.S.-based. It gets to the RCMP. The RCMP notify the police. The police ring our doorbell. So what they had was the cyber tip.
Yep.
And then what they discovered were thumbnails. So a video did go through the account.
Okay.
What we later found out, it didn't go through my son's phone. I'll get to that a little bit later.
Yep.
But the thumbnails that they found supported that a video went through the account. So they connected the dots. And from what I understand, they present this to the Crown. And is there enough there to get a conviction? And the Crown believed that there was. And they press charges.
Okay. So yeah, you said we're about 4 months in now?
4 months in now. Yep. So during that time, what our forensic person did, on top of what I already discovered as far as the suspicious activity email went, he dug deeper into that. But the first thing he did was, and according to him and according to the other forensic person I spoke with, is the first step is you check the authenticating email for an application to see if it's been compromised. You go online, there's a lot of sites, but the one that's favorable amongst the forensic community is haveibeenpawned.com.
Right.
And it's free. You go there, you type in any email address, and it'll tell you if it's ever been involved in a breach. This takes about 30 seconds. And you can also check on that email, on that website, passwords that have been involved in breaches. So when he typed in the Rogers email address that my son used, it was involved in 7 breaches. So what's a breach? A breach is basically, let's say, for example, you register an account at the Home Depot or Walmart or Canadian Tire, and we went living through COVID, a lot of people resorted to online shopping because there was lockdowns, so a lot of accounts were set up. So that email address, that Rogers email address, was involved in 7 breaches. So a breach would be that somebody, a hacker, goes into the server of Home Depot, for example, and steals the account, the customer account information. And they take that information, which can include stuff like IP stuff, date of birth, address, gender, whatever the case may be, and they share it in their hacking community. So that email address that my son used was involved in 7 breaches, but there was so much dirt on it that all that information was pasted on sites where hackers go and basically shop. Mm. So imagine, you know, a sticky, little sticky notes that we use.
Yep.
You write down, here's the email address, here's some IP stuff, here's this, here's that. And you take that digitally and you paste it on a site, and hackers go and shop and say, well, I'm going to use this one anonymously. That's what we believe led to the identity theft of my son's login credentials to a Snapchat account. And if you only have single factor authentication, which is what all you need is for Snapchat.
Yeah, certainly in the early days.
You're more susceptible.
Yeah.
And I'll get to the two-factor authentication later, but if there's anything some people have to remember out of all this, is two-factor authentication.
Essentially keeping yourself protected. We're speaking with Mario Spina today about his family and this whole court situation that happened for them, and we're getting to the court process now that we're into this. So now we're getting into the middle / toward the fall now in 2022. When does a disclosure come from your side, and when does that all come together?
Yeah, so around April, or I think it was April, we had full disclosure, and then we were off to the races. And our forensic person received a digital extract off the phone in question.
Yep.
Around mid-May.
Okay.
And then he went to the police station, and the information from that phone was put on a hard drive, and he took that back to his laboratory in Toronto and did his thing. So roughly in about 30 minutes, him and the technical director of this corporation who came up in the States figured out what happened here. So on Snapchat, and this is how it was told to me, and I'll use you as an example, Dan. Mm-hmm. We're both Snapchat users. If I find your phone number or your username on Snapchat, I can basically send you anything that I want.
Right.
When, and if I send you something, let's say a video, for example, The moment that video finds its destination being your phone would automatically make thumbnail images of that video, and it will store it deep within the application. Now, if you're using an iPhone, which is what my son uses, those images are stored in a restricted area of the phone, inaccessible by the user. The only way you can get there is with forensic software.
Okay.
So I send you something, your phone makes the thumbnails. Now, if I manage to log in to your Snapchat account from my phone, because I have your login credentials or I have password crackers, and it's pretty easy, especially if you only have single-factor authentication, I get into your account easier than what you probably suspect. And using your account from my phone, I contact someone to send me a video. And if it's child pornography, the moment that video lands on my phone through your account, it's going to make these thumbnails and stores them within the application. And then I send that video out to another person who's into this stuff. The moment I send it out of my account, the servers, because that video has already been digitally identified as child exploitation, and rightfully so, notifies the authorities. So it's the distribution charge that really is the bad one and is the trigger point for everything.
Okay.
But what they discovered was, our forensic people, was is that remotely what will happen is the thumbnail images that were stored on my phone in the Snapchat application using under your account will remotely synchronize to your phone.
Oh.
So when it's your doorbell that rings, they will find on your Snapchat account the thumbnail images that were generated on my phone.
Ah.
But they were remotely synchronized. So it's a concept called remote synchronization. So they discovered this in about 30 minutes. And what forensic people will do is they verify and validate. And they keep repeating to make sure that this is what's happening.
Okay.
And this is what they did. He also discovered that at the time of the alleged upload, which was back in August of 2021, my son and his phone in question weren't home. They were at the Canadian Tire store. I sent my son on an errand to pick up something for our trailer. And he remembers that day vividly because it was lockdown. So he was lined up out front of the store with the mask on, 2 meters apart, only so many people allowed in the store at a time. And he logged into the Wi-Fi at Canadian Tire to make sure he comes home with the right part. Well, our forensic person discovered that connection that was made right around the time of the upload. And then when my son exited the store, he bumped into an old high school friend he hasn't seen in a while because, again, COVID.
Yeah.
So that was all discovered. He also discovered that the router we were using from Rogers uses a static IP address. So it doesn't change very often.
Okay.
Versus routers from other providers, which use dynamic IP addresses, which are constantly changing. So it just makes it harder for security breaches. Now with Rogers, maybe it's more easy to manage, I don't know, but when it's a static IP address, you're a little more susceptible. Well, that's what we use. So it was a kind of like a perfect storm of events that kind of led to that doorbell being rung. And this is all given to the Crown for pretrial, which happened in October. I just want to cycle back on one thing about the suspicious activity stuff that I found. His Instagram account was taken over primarily during the time that my son was banned from social media and the police had all of his devices.
Oh.
So that account, which used the same authenticating email, the phone number was changed on it, the email address was changed on it, and then the hacker started doing phishing scams with all his Instagram contacts. And then friends of my son would be calling us directly saying, what's going on with his Instagram stuff?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Well, then they started showing us proof that, you know, it looks like somebody's taken over the account. So this is all happening while the police had his devices and he was banned from social media. And all this other, everything that basically happened under our noses.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, and we'll get into a little bit more of two-factor authentication coming up because clearly this is important for everybody that's listening, especially for young people. Let's get to the part where your lawyers come together and we get to a trial. Tell us how that all comes about.
So the trial is scheduled for pretrial on October 13th. And whatever judge is at the pretrial, If it goes to trial, it will be a totally different judge.
I see.
So the judge coming into the trial knows nothing of the case. And the point of the pretrial is to for both parties to review each other's evidence. And from the part of the defense, you can choose to go with, you know, little evidence, you know, to show the Crown what you have.
Yep.
Or you can choose to go in with a lot. Well, we felt that the evidence we had, which was exculpatory in nature,
yep,
was so compelling, we basically give him everything. Because we, up until that point, we had faith in the police. We suspected they'd probably never seen something quite like this, at least not this technical and the stuff that we're telling them. So we had faith in them. And we thought, we just got to ride this out, stay calm. And when it gets to the lawyers at the pretrial, so it's just both sets of lawyers and the pretrial judge, hopefully there'll be resolution because we strongly believe that there wasn't a case here. We acknowledge they have to act on the information they received, mm-hmm, which we support. They have to act on these tips. But we thought when it gets to the pretrial, it's going to be kind of put to bed.
Okay.
We gave them the forensics report from our expert 2 weeks in advance of the trial, so at the end of September, and the pretrial was October 13th, and the way it was told to me was that the Crown didn't have a report of their own from their police, aside from what their forensic software spits out, and that's it.
Hmm.
So there could be no resolution. So what they do is they say, okay, plan for trial. How long do you need? 2.5 days. Who's your witnesses? And it's kind of laid, the groundwork is laid. So at that point, we thought, well, let's give the Crown and the police another month to see, maybe they need more time to really take this and look at it. What we don't know after reading the trial transcripts and everything is, did the police even look at this report? I suspect they must have, but I didn't see any evidence of that that they did in the trial. We thought once they look at the report, that they're going to maybe reevaluate their investigation. The police aren't there to search for evidence that shows innocence. And to the best of my knowledge, they're not necessarily there to search for evidence that only leads to guilt. They're there to search for evidence. Mm-hmm. And the evidence will lead to its natural conclusion. So we thought when they saw our report that they would go back and reevaluate. I don't know if they did. So a month after the pretrial, still nothing. At that point, that's when I just instructed our lawyers and let's push for trial. Let's force their hand and we will push for trial.
Which was your right to do so, right?
Mm-hmm.
This has to come to a resolution with, what, 18 months of charges, is it? Or?
Yeah, so in Ontario, if you don't go to a superior court, there's an 18-month window from the day of charge until the end of a trial, if there is a trial.
Okay.
And what I can tell you from speaking with legal analysts from other media that we approached and from other lawyers that I've spoken with is there's such a backlog now in Ontario for the criminal court system because these are serious charges and we totally are aware of that. The Crown, they don't want to risk putting a guilty person back on the street.
Mm.
And from discussions that we've had, from what we've heard, a lot of times in these type of circumstances, the people are guilty. So they don't want to take that chance.
Okay.
And they just leave it up to the courts to decide. Well, if you don't get something solved within that 18-month window, the case gets tossed. So maybe there's a potential of people who are really guilty being back on the street because the system is backlogged.
Right.
So back to this case, had more, what we like to say, proper investigation, or a more thorough investigation been done, this should have never have gone to court.
Hmm.
So we took up the court's time. We took up everybody's time. It was a great expense to us. We dipped deep into our pension savings to fund all this. And the stress that it caused my son and my family has been nothing short of immense and life-changing.